Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Thanks for joining me today, Chris.
Sure, my pleasure.
Our first guest is Zach Schoenbrunn. He's written a new book called The Performance Cortex: How Neuroscience is Redefining Athletic Genius. The more we understand the brain's impact on the way our bodies move and its application to things like hitting a baseball or hitting a bullseye on a dartboard, the more obvious it is that sports and neuroscience are inextricably linked. Very soon, scanning draft prospects' brains with an EEG will become as standard as a yearly physical. The Performance Cortex is a book that not only challenges how we understand athletic genius, but in the same way that Moneyball changed our understanding of sports a decade ago, it fundamentally alters how we see the intersection of athleticism, the brain, and the future of sports. Zach Schoenbrunn, welcome. Zach, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
No problem at all. Yes. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. And first, let me ask you about how you got to this book. I mean, you are a journalist, a very accomplished journalist, I might add, for the New York Times and many other publications. But I believe it was an alumni magazine, which, you know what, everyone should read their alumni magazines because they're always so interesting. But I think you said your wife found this little mention of these two neuroscientists doing work on baseball players. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I was going to say that, yes, you should read your alumni magazines because they are great for ideas and for stories. But, of course, it wasn't me that noticed the story that would ultimately change my life. It was my wife. So I'll do credit to her. And she had noticed this small little blurb about these two neuroscientists that were doctoral students at the time at Columbia University. But they were starting to branch out and do some work with Major League Baseball teams. And they had come up with a way to use a neuroimaging technique called EEG and use that to assess and quantify decision-making in professional hitters. And so they were just starting in their journey and their work, and I've continued to follow them and followed them for the next 3 years. I ended up writing a story about them, but it was kind of like a song that couldn't get unstuck out of my head. I kept on thinking, what are they finding? What are they looking for exactly? You know, I had been covering sports and I've been a sports fan my whole life, and I've obviously been focused on the body and the physicality of sports and hitting. We talk about, you know, reaction time and hand-eye coordination and all these things. But, you know, they were actually pinpointing skill, essentially, inside the brain of these hitters. And so I thought, well, if they could do that for baseball, are there other ways that perhaps we could pinpoint skill in the brains of other athletes? And then it really got me to understand or appreciate the role that the brain plays in not just elite athleticism, but just our movement on a daily basis as we move about the world. So that's where I am today.
So this is about them trying to quantify, like you said, perhaps decision-making skills, and not necessarily reaction time skills.
That's right. Yeah, you know, hitting a baseball is an extraordinary task. A baseball arrives at home plate, a 95-mile-an-hour pitch will arrive at home plate in 400 milliseconds. That's 4/10 of a second. Right. But that doesn't even account for the length of a pitcher's stride, or the fact that a lot of pitchers use deception and you don't know what pitch is actually coming, mm-hmm. and the fact that a lot of pitchers these days throw harder than 95 miles an hour.
Right.
And then you have to factor in the fact that to perceive and to create a motor output to actually swing at the pitch costs you about 200 milliseconds. So already your time to react is cut in half. So hitters are not just seeing and reacting. Physically, that would be impossible. So the idea that they're reaction machines is actually kind of a misnomer. They're prediction machines. They use their brains and they use their experience to pick up on cues that can help them to predict what pitch might be coming. And in that amount of time, that prediction is generates a decision to swing or not to swing. And it's a binary decision. That's all you need to do. But these neuroscientists were the first to actually be able to detect the decision, not just the swing, which we could always see because they swung, there's movement mm-hmm. there, but actually the decision not to swing. So no movement at all, yet it still is neural activations. It is your brain responding to what it's seeing and making an active decision without any motor output. So that was unique in what these neuroscientists were able to tell teams.
So how do they go about doing this? They wire them up while they're in the batter's box, in the batting cage?
Right. Well, so they're not able to wire them in the batting cage. And the way the technology is today, you can't really be standing and mobile using neuroimaging equipment, which makes it somewhat difficult and challenging for motor research. But what they did is they created a simulation that simulates an oncoming pitch, and they've done a pretty good job at using data and statistics from actual pitchers, and so they can replicate the motion and the speed of an oncoming pitch from any pitcher that is available in Major Leagues today. There's so many statistics out there that are publicly available about pitch, and so they use some algorithms and equations to actually to have a simulation that can accurately simulate what a pitch looks like as it's coming in, and then the hitter, wearing an EEG cap, sitting in front of a laptop screen, will have to decide whether to swing or not swing at this pitch, if it's in the strike zone or out of the strike zone, or if it's the pitch that they're supposed to be looking for. And so from there, you can kind of get a baseline for how the brain is making decisions.
Our sports are generally so dynamic, and I don't know if you're familiar with our town, Park City, but, you know, we do a lot of sport here. But they're all involving movement, skiing, mountain biking. And I'm wondering if the reason that Sherwin and Marask and these two neuroscientists chose baseball is because it is static. I mean, relatively, when you're in, you know, as Chris said, the batting cage, or when you're standing at ready to receive a pitch. Is that why they chose baseball, or was there some other reason?
No, you're absolutely right. It is baseball has presented itself as a somewhat easier sport to model and quantify analytically than some other sports, and that's why it was arguably the first to get into that, to the Moneyball revolution, because you're talking about, you know, one single pitch at a time, then you reset, and so on. Whereas a more dynamic sport like basketball or football or hockey or even snowboarding, a lot of movement, a lot of activity, things are happening all at the same time, and so it's a little bit harder to quantify, although, you know, we are starting to get there. And so for that reason, baseball has been a little bit easier and was the first to jump into the analytics revolution. But Jason Sherwin and Jordan Maraskin saw hitting specifically as a much cleaner opportunity for using the EEG and assessing decision making, because it's a single interaction, and it's one pitch at a time, and it's decide to swing or not to swing. It's basically this binary decision, and so you can provide analytics and you can pinpoint the millisecond that a decision is made, pitch by pitch by pitch. And so for that reason, baseball seemed to be a little bit easier as a jumping off point, but they would absolutely love to get into other sports and other areas. I mean, we make decisions all the time, and so if you can use neuroimaging to assess and quantify that, there seems to be no limitations on what the possibilities are.
I'm wondering, you know, there has been the last 10 or 15 years, so much that we've discovered about the brain with neuroscience. I mean, about cognition, about mental illness, about brain injury, so much more we can quantify that we perhaps suspected before, but now it's real in numbers. And so I'm wondering, did their research come out of some other area of study, for example, you know, brain injury? Because it seems like that's a big area of study. And it's interesting because I think this is the first time I've heard about this type of study within the brain.
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're absolutely right. A lot of what we've learned about the brain, and specifically what we've learned about the brain and its control and coordination of movement, has stemmed from studies of those with disease or impairments, and they're unable to move, and so looking at the localization of the brain and how it contributes to movement has been hugely impactful on their understanding. But actually, Jason and Jordan started by looking at musicians. When they were at Columbia, Jason was doing a study using EEG, and I believe he was using fMRI as well, and he was looking at cellists, and he would compare how they would pick up on notes and while they're playing, and also adjust to what they're hearing to make sure that they're still on pitch or their tune is correct. And he noticed by scanning their brains that their motor activations were different than novices in certain ways. And so by that information, it got them thinking, well, if these expert cellists their motor areas are activating differently by the things that they're hearing and their decisions while they're playing, perhaps we could use this information to try and see what athletes are doing in their decision making and how their motor areas might differ from novices and so on. And they were the first, as far as I know, to actually put baseball players into a scanner, into the fMRI, and look at the brain regions that are responsible for hitting a pitch. And so it's just continued, obviously, onward from there.
I want to go back to helping better understand what this is about by understanding what it's not about, because you can have a great athlete that has all the physical attributes of being a great, let's say, baseball player, five-tool player or so. But this is not about physical attributes per se. It's not necessarily about IQ. It's not about, let's say, relaxation techniques that they might employ while they're at the plate or so. This is, like you say, this is about decision-making processes on millisecond basis, looking at cues and gathering information from the pitchers, the arc, the position of their arm, the spin of the ball as it comes off their hand, not halfway down. Literally, they have to pick up this information, process this information as it's coming off their hand. This is what that's all about. This is what this is about.
Absolutely. And one of the most telling anecdotes that they felt like they were on the right track was very early on in their use of EEG, and they went to Bradley University and they scanned the brains of several of the hitters at Bradley. And the Bradley coaches at that time had been confounded about a certain player. I think he was their star shortstop or something like that, who was a fantastic athlete, multiple sports. He had all the physical attributes you'd want, and he had a beautiful swing. And the coaches couldn't understand what it was that was holding him back from fulfilling his potential as a hitter. He just did not seem to be responding to pitches in the way that they expected him to, considering his physical attributes. And it wasn't until DeCervo came along and was able to show that his decision-making on certain pitches was not up to par with his teammates. And therefore, it had nothing to do with how beautiful his swing may have looked. It had much more to do with his rapid perceptual decision making that was in his brain. And so you can use that. Teams are now trying to figure out what to use that, how to use that information. Mm-hmm. Do we use that information to train? Do we use that information to scout and assess future players? And so that's where this is headed. But I think to answer your question, the physical can often betray us and lead us down the wrong path, whereas, really what it comes down to is a better understanding of the cognition and the neural activation that are occurring in your brain that are underlying all our movements. That's where sports eventually, I think, will have to head in order to make better decisions about prospects or players that we might be drafting or watching as we watch games.
So I'm wondering, let's go back to that player at Bradley University. What was done with him then? He has all of this raw talent and trained talent, developed talent. But with his, I guess I would say, limited neural activation in some of these decision-making skills, what do we do? Are they able to train that into him, or is this sort
Can
of what you're given?
Right. No, it's a good question. And, I think what we understand now is that, you know, having that understanding that DeServo, the company, can break down various by pitch to say that you're responding to a fastball versus responding to a slider versus responding to a curveball. And so potentially you can use that information. This player is not responding as quickly to the curveball as he might be to the slider or compared to his teammates. And so therefore you can kind of reverse engineer and say, all right, maybe I should start feeding him more curveballs in batting practice and so on. So it can be a training tool. And I'm not certain that that's what, in fact, Bradley University decided to do with this player. You know, DeServo, what intrigued me about them was they never positioned themselves as an improvement device or a brain gaming performance enhancing device. They were simply providing information to the teams to do with it what they felt was necessary. And I think, you know, it's going to take a little bit more time. We're still very nascent in this technology and this understanding of what this technology might be able to provide to teams. So, you know, it's going to take some time to really understand, okay, are there ways to train? Are there ways to improve that decision-making? But it's another source of information that teams can use to analyze, you know, why a hitter might be struggling or to detect, you know, what a potential hitter might be able to offer down the road.
Mm. If you're just tuning in to Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Zach Schoenbrunn, who has written The Performance Cortex, How Neuroscience is Redefining Athletic Genius. We're talking about neuroscience that has allowed us to see decision-making, split-second decision-making. I just want to ask you, Zach, if where we're going to go with the EEGs, you know, in recruiting and, you know, college visitations of these athletes, it's a little bit
NFL
scary.
Combine comes
yeah,
to mind, right?
It sounds a little bit scary to me because, you know, if your neuroscience is showing that you just don't have the decision-making skill, then all of this other talent that you've developed over your whole lifetime, does it get discounted?
Put at risk?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're right. If you put it that way, it can be a little scary. And I think we're still a ways away from that. You know, and teams that might be thinking of this as a scouting or screening method, I think currently they're saying it's another source of information that they can add that can factor in to a decision down the road to perhaps draft or sign a player. You know, the limitations right now with neuroimaging equipment such as EEG, as I mentioned, it's, you know, you can't be moving around in it, you can't be in a batting cage, you have to be stationary, and movement, too much movement will corrupt the data. So it's a somewhat prohibitive experience. You have to wear an EEG cap and you know, if the electrode cream you know, squeezed into your hair, and then you have to sit in front of a laptop screen for 40 minutes. And so for that reason, you know, players don't really enjoy the assessment, and teams don't really enjoy putting their players through an assessment. So until the technology has gotten great enough that perhaps, you know, someone will be able to move about in an EEG and wear it around you know, be in a batting cage while you're using it, I think we're still a few years away from it really, you know, taking off in sports. But once that happens, you know, I'll be honest, I don't see any reason why that information and that technology would not be used or incorporated in some way in sports. I think what the technology will tell you, or what proponents of the technology will tell you, is that the decision maker, you're going to find out about their lack of decision-making ability eventually. And, you know, if they're not able to respond to a pitch the way that their teammates are, you know, they might have the best-looking physical attributes in the world, and they may have put in plenty of time and energy into practicing certain things, but maybe it just wasn't the right thing. And I think it would have caught up with them eventually. And so this, you know, a lot of the things that we have today in terms of scouting and assessing athletes, we talk about the physical, we talk about, and sports science has evolved to factor in nutrition, and we understand sleep, and we understand, you know, the importance of stretching and yoga. But those still, to me, they're a bit like understanding that cold weather and stress will contribute to a higher chance of you developing a cold. But it doesn't say anything about what it is about the cold weather and the stress that actually gives you upper respiratory symptoms. And neuroscience can actually be that explanation. And I think it can, teams can use that information in a much better way than they're currently using the physical assessments that we use in scouting today.
Let's talk about some other sports where this might apply. I play a lot of tennis, so I can see this applying in the area of returning a serve. Serves coming at you 130 miles an hour. And so you have to have your reaction, your processing has to be incredibly based on sensory perception, where the toss is. You know, you're incorporating your knowledge of the game to identify where the ball might go or how the ball might be spinning based on the toss, and also based on prior knowledge of that opponent's thoughts about where he typically might serve the ball, first or second serve. So all of this plays into that reaction time too, right?
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. You know, fast moving sports, we tend to think of baseball and tennis as being, those who excel at them as being like reaction machines.
Yes.
See ball, hit ball. But that couldn't be further from the truth. Our bodies, as I mentioned earlier, with the speed of the pitch, our bodies have such limitations imposed on us, and the signals take a long time. We're talking about tiny little neurons that have to travel a long way to move your legs and move your arms. We don't often think about that, but it takes time, and that time costs us, and especially if you're talking about responding to a 150-mile-an-hour serve. So how is it that Roger Federer does it? And the answer, at least what they think could be the answer or the model for how it's able to be done, is actually using a kind of equation or an algorithm called Bayes' theorem from Thomas Bayes way back in the 18th century, and it's basically a probability.
Right.
And so what he does is that he, instead of taking that ball that's incoming and saying this is where it's going to be, he takes that as a likelihood, and he combines that likelihood with, as you mentioned, prior knowledge and prior experience. How many times have I faced this opponent before? What do I expect in this setting for him to serve? How much spin is he going to put on the ball? What's the wind? What are the conditions like? Is there wind? Is there sun in my eye? And so by multiplying that prior experience with the likelihood of the ball coming toward me, I actually get at a different answer for where I think the ball is going to land. And that's essentially how Roger Federer is able to make accurate probabilities on an incoming vessel that's approaching him at speeds that are really almost impossible for him to just simply react to. So, you know, it's just another layer of expertise and decision-making that, you know, the more practice and preparation he has put into it, all that prior experience, prior knowledge, you can understand now why Federer is not making as many mistakes as you or I are making when we're returning a serve.
Right, and he's also a genius at being able to serve different balls using the same toss. So there's no cues, there's no tells. That's the word. There's no tells in his toss when he serves. His toss is always the same, but he hits a spin serve or a flat serve or one to the right or one to the left. So it takes away that part of that equation, I think you say, that prior knowledge or those or maybe the sensory evidence or so. Whereas John Isner just rears up and serves 140 miles an hour, and you just have to reset your reaction time, much in the same way ball players reset their reaction time to, say, Aroldis Chapman's 105-mile-an-hour fastball. You just adjust over time. So
right. And, you know, there was a fascinating story in the New York Times a few years ago about exactly that, hitting Aroldis Chapman's 105-mile-an-hour fastball. And you'd think, you know, again, how could it be possible? But, in fact, I think he's thrown maybe 26 of fastballs of that speed, and like 21 of them players actually made contact with that pitch. And so you think, how is that possible? And so they are picking up on cues and hints that are perhaps, you know, they're not just subtle. They're actually perhaps perceivable only by somebody who's actively playing and actively in that moment. Yeah. And that perception contributes to action in a way that we really don't have an appreciation for. There was an amazing study a few years ago out of Rome in which they took, I think it was maybe a half a dozen professional basketball players. These were elite basketball players in an Italian basketball league, and they had them watch a player taking a free throw. And it was zoomed in on his hand, and then the film cut out as soon as the ball left the player's fingertips. And they asked the participants, can you guess whether the ball went in or out, just strictly from this information in the video? Hmm. And the players, beyond the expectations of those who were conducting the study, they were much more accurate at guessing whether the ball went in or not than even their coaches that had also been tested and other experts that, you know, fans and bloggers and reporters and so on, former players who also had been tested on the same video. And the idea is that by actively participating in that sport, you can effectively simulate the movement itself as you're watching it, and it activates motor areas that can inform you in a way that a layperson or someone on the sidelines cannot even begin to replicate. So a very informative study there, and I think it goes a long way to explaining what sort of cues and how our brains respond to those cues in a way that enhances our performance.
I'm wondering, you know, for so long, I guess because we haven't had neuroscience to tell us exactly how quick our decision making is, but we've referred to it as things like, oh, you know, intuition, or, you know, our fast twitch muscles are working really well, or our reaction time is this, but that's about all we have assigned to it. So very interesting that now we can quantify it. And I want to go back to something you talked about earlier, but, you know, that ability to train it. You know, I'm thinking about ski racers and their training reaction time and training their muscles to be able to handle that quick, you know, very quick movement based on the decisions they have to make. But knowing what we know, I mean, have they gone back and after trying to train better decision-making into your movement, has that been measured and is it quantifiably, you know, improved?
You know, I don't think the baseball teams have done anything quite like you're asking yet. You know, they're still a few years into this. And what they've been doing is they've been looking at the lower-level prospects at this point, the rookie level players, the guys who have just been drafted, they frankly don't want to burden the really elite players, the major leaguers, quite yet with these fancy headgear and all that electric cream and all that stuff. I mean, trust me, I would love one day to have some information about, you know, what a player like Mike Trout's brain might look like and his decision making ability, what it might read on a scanner, but I think that time has yet to come, and so they're still gathering that kind of information, and so they're, you know, we're at the point now where maybe players have been tested a few times or repeatedly tested, but until that data begins to accumulate, it's a little hard to say whether or not training will noticeably improve that decision-making, at least over the course of, you know, one season or two. I mean, of course, you know, there's no evidence yet of a brain being born to play sports, but there is plenty of evidence of the plasticity of our brains, certainly in childhood and adolescence and even into adulthood. Our brain regions and neurons respond to practice and experience. They respond in ways that reflect whatever task that we're trying to participate in. And so that takes time. That's the reason it might take 10,000 hours, yeah. Quoting Anders Ericsson there, to become an expert, is because it's not because it takes that long to bolster your muscles. It's because it takes that long for your brain to reflect the changes in the practice that you put into it. So over the course of a season or two, it might be a little tough to see how that training could impact, but certainly, you know, it's something that we'll have to find out and watch and see.
We just have another minute or so, real quick. The name of the company that's doing this work is Decervo, D-E-C-E-R-V-O. What are they doing right now?
So right now they're just continuing to work with teams and trying to fulfill whatever the teams want from them. I think, you know, there's still a little bit of hesitancy to go full in with the EEG and the neuroscience, because I think there's a little bit of concern about, you know, putting the players through too much. And listen, these are major league teams. They want results. Now, they're not so interested in the science. I think Jason and Jordan, understand that this takes time and you need to assess a lot of players and gather a lot of data. So it's probably not moving as quickly as they would like. But, you know, again, they are kind of the breakthrough in this. And I think as more people become aware of the potential and more teams follow suit, I don't see any reason why this wave is not going to carry on throughout the Major League Baseball, and we'll see more and more of it.
Yeah.
This is the quantum theory of physics. You know, this is related to the quantum theory. Sorry, Lynn is giving me the cutoff sign, but that's how I'm thinking. We're getting down into the quantum theory, the quantum waves of baseball analytics.
That's right. Well, the book is The Performance Cortex, How Neuroscience is Redefining Athletic Genius. Our guest, Zach Schoenbrunn. Very interesting, Zach. And yeah. Also, listeners can find an article by you in the New York Times.
Yes.
I think it came
today's.
Out about, oh, was it today's?
Yeah,
I thought it was a couple days ago.
It was online.
Anyway, we found it online. Very interesting. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
it was great being with you.
All right.